Good evening, and welcome to tonight's program, hosted by the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. My name is Steve Moore. It is my pleasure to introduce Peter Thiel, author of 0 to 1, Notes on Startups, or How to Build a Future. Peter is an entrepreneur and investor. After taking PayPal public and then selling it to eBay, he has become known as the Don of the PayPal Mafia. Since so many of his former colleagues have gone on to start successful companies, including SpaceX, Tesla Motors, LinkedIn, YouTube, and Yelp. In 2004, Peter himself started Palantir Technologies, a data analytics company that makes tools for national security and global finance. That same year, he also made the first outside investment in Facebook, where he continues to serve on the board of directors. Today, as a partner of Founders Fund in his own investing, he works to identify and support the next generation of technology companies. He also started the Thiel Foundation and the 20 Under 20 Thiel Fellowship, helping to ignite a debate on the differences that might exist between learning and schooling. Peter received his bachelor's and law degrees from Stanford University. Moderating tonight's conversation is Quentin Hardy, Deputy Tech Editor for the New York Times. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Peter and Quentin.
Thank you so much. Ooh, okay. Well, I don't think Peter Thiel will mind if I say that he and his book almost revel in embracing contradiction. While clearly a free market capitalist, Mr. Thiel champions monopoly and disdains competition, albeit along very specific terms that we'll get into in this discussion. He yearns for people to take risks, seemingly to build wealth, but also to create in people and in society a kind of courage to reach into themselves and have larger visions for what they in society might be. He is at least some kind of libertarian, by his own admission, but admires an era when America had bold vision for moonshots and superhighways, which, after all, were projects funded by big government. He rails that we have become a society of rote thinking and checkmark advancement, but his own pedigree is gold-plated. Stanford undergrad, Stanford law, prestigious law clerkship, big New York law firm, at which point he threw it all away. Chucked it, came out here with a tight group of friends, and founded PayPal in 1998, a payments company that set out to essentially create a new kind of currency and destabilize state-run currencies, ended up changing systems of payments and ending up very much in the news today, and was sold to eBay in 2002 for $1.5 billion. Since then, he has been an early investor in Facebook. His $500,000 investment has made him a billionaire. He co-founded Palantir, a data analysis company that works in the beginning with intelligence agencies and now I think about 80% with private companies to find interesting patterns that they can exploit. The company has been valued at about $9 billion last year. He's also started Founders Fund, an alternative kind of VC investment fund, and runs a couple of hedge funds. Gosh, you just can't hold a job, can you? Now, for all this, I said I don't think he minds if I say he embraces contradictions, because what runs through his story is very rich intellectual curiosity and combat, and a view that no idea cannot continually be refined, and that things should be thought through deeply. People should have convictions on a wild and extreme level. So they might seem contradictory and crazy, but they should be brave enough to find these beliefs in themselves and raise them and have them challenged, which is something I hope to do somewhat tonight. At its most radical, I think this is the intention of the book he has written, 0 to 1. Seemingly a business book developed out of a series of Stanford lectures, but there's something more to it than that, I think. The 0 to 1 he speaks of is moving from something not existing in the world to rising in the mind of its creator and then expressing itself usually in a market and creating an entirely new space for commerce and life in the world. This, he feels, is entrepreneurship at its best. And with a series of anecdotes and analysis, he hopes to help people realize something like this goal. So let me start my conversation by asking you a little bit about the reception of the book. What's been some of the most surprising things people have made of what you've written?
Well, it's surprising actually how positive the reception's been. I've been able to have a lot of really interesting conversations with people about some of the themes in this book. People have told me how much it's gotten them to think about different things. There certainly are parts of it where you always get a sense that it's not that easy to communicate the ideas. So one of the ideas that I've hammered over and over again, and yet I still don't know if I quite succeed in getting it across, is this idea that, I sort of start by asking this question: tell me something that's true that most people don't agree with you on, and then the book gives a whole series of answers to this question.
Do you find most people can actually find that question themselves? What do I believe that nobody else thinks is true?
It's a very hard interview question. So if you actually ask it to someone in an interview, it's quite hard, and people tend to do very badly. And they still do badly even when they read on the internet that I ask people this question in an interview.
Right.
And so it's one of these strange questions. It's not like a math puzzle question where you can read up on the puzzle and ace it. This is one where even if you know the question in advance, you don't do much better. And the reason people find it so hard is, I think, because there's always like this courage component where a good answer is one that the person asking it won't agree with. So you have to have the courage to say something the person asking the question is unlikely to agree with. And we sort of live in a world where I think courage is in far shorter supply than genius. But I think that I suspect people do have a number of answers to this that they might not want to share. So I think people have answers to these questions that they don't want to share. I don't want to share all of my answers. I think it's generally,
Are you suggesting you believe a lot of things that most people don't believe?
Oh, I believe a lot of things, and I mention a lot of them in this book. I don't mention all of them in this book, but I go through. This book is sort of a whole series of things that I believe to be true that I think a lot of people don't agree with me on, and probably the biggest theme and one that I sort of bring up in many of these discussions and presentations over the last few weeks as I've been promoting this book is the idea that most people think that competition and capitalism are synonyms, and I think they're antonyms. And I think, a capitalist is someone who's in the business of accumulating capital. A world of perfect competition is a world where all the profits are competed away. And then I go on from there to talk about how in business you want to do something that's very differentiated, very unique, that has a monopoly.
It could be argued you're using language in very special ways when you say monopoly good, competition stupid.
Right.
These are specific types of competitive environments and specific types of monopolies, aren't they?
Sure. But the one point I want to make is the thing that people, so when I give this sort of presentation, and what people have generally heard is, wow, he must be against capitalism. So obviously you're in favor of competition. Everyone's in favor of competition. And even though my whole talk is about how I think competition's a bad idea, we live in a society where we're taught to compete. You're taught to compete from the time you're, in school, preschool, K through 16. And competition does help you get better at certain things. If you're on a high school athletic team and you compete, you get better than the people next to you at whatever sport you're playing. Or if you spend lots of time practicing for a standardized test, you will get better at the answers on that standardized test. So when you compete, you do get better at this game of beating the people around you. But I think it always comes at this very high price of losing sight of what is important.
When you have multiple people in a space, there are a finite number of resources that they
Of what is important or valuable. And the sort of the autobiographical part of this, just touching to the thing you said about my history, is that I do think that when I was a teenager, when I was in my 20s, I was a hyper-competitive person. You know, my eighth grade yearbook in junior high school, one of my friends put in, I know you're going to get into Stanford as a sophomore in 4 years, and that's sort of roughly what happened. And then I went to law school, and then I ended up getting into a top law firm on Wall Street, where on the outside everybody wanted to get in, on the inside everybody wanted to get out. When I left after 7 months and 3 days, one of the people down the hall from me said, you know, it's really reassuring to see you leave. I had no idea it was possible to escape from Alcatraz. And
Have you ever checked in to see if he's still there?
It would be worth checking. I suspect.
It's a prison of his own mind, isn't it?
But this was what almost all the people there thought, because our identities get so wrapped up in the things we compete on. People couldn't actually imagine leaving. And so I do think this question of competition needs to be rethought, and I would define it very simply as competition.
Well, let's take a specific to perhaps, you know, bring this into a sharper light. In the case of monopoly and competition, Yahoo and Alta Vista were competing in search. Google showed up and was seemingly competing in search. You're saying it was doing something entirely new that has granted it a monopoly space that no one else can get close to.
Yes.
But so, surely it was competing with those other two.
It was, well, you know, it's sort of, if you have submachine guns against bows and arrows, that's sort of very one-sided. And so, if the competitors are roughly equal, that's where you have very intense competition. It's when things are very differentiated, that's when things just shift. And Google was so much better. You know, Yahoo felt they had to adopt it as their back-end engine. And it was in a sense, there was some complicated business development things Google had to get right. But I would argue that it was so much better that in some ways it didn't really compete nearly as intensely as when people are more similar. You know, there's this Henry Kissinger quote describing his fellow professors at Harvard, where, you know, the battles in academia are so intense because the stakes are so small, mm-hmm. which always sounds like sort of a formula for insanity. You know, why are these people so crazy? If the stakes are so small, why are the battles so intense? But it also describes, I think, the inner logic of the situation, that when you can't differentiate yourself, you have to fight even harder to maintain some sort of small differences. If you're mm-hmm. like a two-star Michelin chef, you will be fighting around the clock to make sure you can keep your two stars. You know, you might kill yourself if you go from two stars to one star. And so in these hyper-competitive things, you have to fight incredibly hard just to stay where you are.
Right. Another word I think you use in a very specific context is entrepreneur. Most entrepreneurs in this country are in some equivalent of opening a pizza parlor. Mm-hmm. But to you, an entrepreneur really stakes out an entirely new space, right?
Yes, I definitely... Yeah, well, I think entrepreneur is always a tricky word at this point. You know, we have a gold rush mentality in Silicon Valley. And so I'm always skeptical of people who say, you know, when I grow up, I want to be an entrepreneur. That's like saying, when I grow up, I want to be rich, I want to be famous. And I think it's a better frame is that you start new companies or new ventures as a way to solve problems that you can't solve within existing institutions, and that things are driven by the fact that there are these important problems that otherwise would not get solved. That's a much healthier way, I find, to sort of define what you're doing, rather than I just needed a line on my resume that said entrepreneur, and if that didn't work, I would go, you know, I'll go back to business school.
I'll go back to Wall Street, right. But inside the Valley, you talk about this kind of as a horizontalist mentality. I'll involve myself in the current situation with something incrementally better, and I'll compete in that. Don't you find most venture capitalists are also pretty horizontal? High-risk areas are tougher to back. Aren't they backing generally incrementalist, horizontal ventures?
Yeah, well, there's always, one of the big challenges when you're investing money, there's always this difference between investing your own money and investing other people's money. And the fundamental difference is, when you invest your own money, you're just trying to get good returns. When you invest other people's money, you're trying to always do two things. Number one, get good returns. number two, look like you're going to get good returns. And there's a surprisingly large disconnect between those two things, because when it looks like you're going to get good returns, it's that you will do things that most people think make sense. If most people think they make sense, they will be conventional, they will somehow already be priced in, and so it does not work. So I think there's always a bias to say, we're doing this investment, it looks just like this other one that worked, and this is why this also makes sense.
Right.
So we end up putting too much money into the fourth online pet food company or the 10th thin film solar panel company, whereas something that's sort of in a one-of-a-kind category gets very underfunded. The most controversial investment founders fund ever made was investing in Elon's SpaceX company in summer of 08.
I mean, I'll bet it was your favorite.
It's worked out really well. I'm not just into offending people, you know.
We had
LPs who had looked at investing in our fund and didn't invest, write us and say, you know, this is the dumbest investment I've ever seen anybody make. I'm so glad I didn't give you guys money. And if you know how risk-averse LPs are as a category, for them to voluntarily send a nasty gram to you takes quite a lot.
Well, I said I bet it was your favorite, not because I, you know, to say you're a contrarian or you're a contradictory person, but you like to move into areas where there aren't a lot of incumbents, there aren't a lot of regulations, you're free to explore. Outer space sounds pretty good for all that stuff, right? You know, that's a good place to go. And it was a limited number of customers, potentially many more customers. And it was also a rather long-term engagement.
Yeah, I think, I think all these things are underrated. So we want the venture capitalists, the other venture capitalists tend to skew towards short-term things. So I like long-term because, again, that's less competitive. You know, it can't be super long-term. And if it's... This was always the disconnect between, say, Japanese and U.S. approaches to business. U.S. businesses we always critique for being on this quarterly earnings cycle. Japan argued in the 80s that it had sort of much longer time horizons. And there's a point where long-term can be just a euphemism for procrastination or for avoiding accountability. I think in its best form, there are definitely things that take 5 or 10 years to build, and we should be building more of those.
I wanted to ask you about your tuition in this in the form of two different funds you've run. Clarium, which famously at its apex in 2008 had $7.2 billion and fantastic returns, and then you had a couple of bad years, and 90% of the money was withdrawn. And as I understand it, effectively now it's pretty much a family fund, even though between 2002 and 2011, the annual average rate of return was 12%. You beat the S&P, but once things started to go sideways, all the money got pulled because they're traders, right? And then you funded Mithril, where you locked in investor money for 12 years. Like, people had to go long-term if they're going to put money against this. And my question looking at that is having convictions good for an entrepreneur but bad for a trader?
I'm always on the side that convictions are important. If you don't have convictions, you always get lost. But I think there are things in a liquid hedge fund context. There are the sort of disconnect between managing your own money, the other people's money disconnect is very acute because. Every month it's, we don't believe your theory. What are you doing? Why are you doing this? And there are sort of ways that the marketing can get you into a very bad place. I think it's in a venture capital context where the money is locked up for 10 or 12 years, that can be somewhat more attenuated. It still in practice ends up being a big challenge for people, but it's somewhat more attenuated. I think we always downplay how much we're influenced and influenced by the people around us. And this is always, the word ape already in the time of Shakespeare meant both primate and to imitate. And there is this sort of ape-like, sheep-like, lemming-like, herd-like aspect to human nature. And there are good things to it. It's how, you know, culture is transmitted. It's how kids learn to speak language from their parents. But there also are these bad aspects to it, because it leads to all these bubbles. It leads to all these sort of mass delusions, mass insanities, and it's something that one should always try to resist, and we should never underestimate how much of this we're prone to.
I must also ask, just out of morbid curiosity, I've never had $6.5 billion leave my control. What's that like emotionally?
It's not that much fun.
Really? Good, that affirms it. I guess now I don't have to do that. Now, you're also quoted as saying famously, we were promised flying cars, and finish the sentence. And we got
140 characters.
We got 140 characters. Not taking Twitter to task, that was last week. But, you know, you say that we're deeply lacking in vision now. But, you know, in my work, just going on the Valley, I was thinking about this on the way over. Facebook wants to connect the world and essentially overthrow the world's telecommunication structure, as far as I can tell. Uber is not going to stop at cabs. They want to control every fleet vehicle on the planet. Google, with self-driving cars, is out to remake urban transport. Monsanto says to me that they want to put under close cultivation, i.e. every square meter, over 1 million acres on the planet. GE talks about robotics factories with high levels of instrumentation, you know, across the globe. What's the vision problem in all that? That sounds pretty rich to me.
Well, I think that there is a decent amount of vision in the world of computing, information technology, and we've had a lot of innovation, computers, internet, mobile internet. My claim has been that over the last 40 years, there's generally been less innovation in the world of atoms. It's not been a good idea to go into all the engineering disciplines that had to do with atoms. It was not a good idea to become, you know, a nuclear engineer, a mechanical engineer, a chemical engineer, an aeroastro engineer. And so we had less innovation in areas like energy or transportation. Biomedical, I think, was a much tougher area to go into than programming. There certainly is a hope that at this point things will reaccelerate, that there's going to be ways in which the world of information technology will be sort of reintegrated into the world of atoms. And this is like self-driving cars or a lot of these other companies are looking to do that. But I think the last 40 years have been this very odd period where we've had this narrow cone around computers where there's been tremendous progress, but many other areas that have been relatively stagnant. The hope is things will accelerate in the years ahead. It's not yet clear that's going to happen.
In every case, I think those big visions I was talking about have to do with a more recent transformation of essentially deploying machine intelligence everywhere with lots of mobility and lots of back-end cloud computing connections, so you can do big analysis and receive a lot of two-way information. And that does appear to be affecting other practices as well. Optimally, what is your vision of the future, sort of 10 years out, 15? You know, what do you see the great advances that might be if we do reach into ourselves and take these risks?
Well, I think we could be doing a lot more in biotech and life sciences, and there sort of are questions whether some of these fields will become more like an information science. So I do think the question of can people live longer and healthier lives is one that that sort of affects all of us in a pretty deep existential way. Nixon declared war on cancer in 1970. It was supposed to be defeated by the bicentennial in 1976. You know, we're 44 years later. We're certainly 44 years closer to the goal than we were 44 years ago, but the expected time is probably more than 6 years. But I think there's some hope that we could make somewhat more progress on that. Dementia, one out of three people at age 85 has dementia or Alzheimer's, and certainly that would be one that would be, you know, high on my list of things we should be trying to really do something about. So I think there are sort of a lot of these
biology-based changes.
Or turning biology into an information science may be a way to really accelerate the progress mm-hmm. there. So that's an area that I think would be very interesting. I certainly think there's going to continue to be a lot on the computer side, you mm-hmm. know, and I think the things that are very interesting are all the ones that are sort of somehow integrated into the, you know, real world, mm-hmm. In quotes. I think there's always sort of this temptation on the part of people in the computer industry to be sort of separated from the real world and sort of like get a sense, it's sort of like the Asperger sense where you're more comfortable talking to a computer than talking to people, and you sort of want to retreat into this virtual world. But I think a lot of the companies that worked actually had a tight connection. You know, PayPal, the key thing was to do it with real dollars, not with a weird alternate currency.
This is a very interesting point.
Facebook was real people, not, my friend Reid Hoffman, who ended up starting LinkedIn, in 1997 started a company called SocialNet. So the whole idea of social networking was already in the name, 1997, like 6-7 years before people were even talking about it as a theme. But the idea was that, you know, everyone would have this avatar in cyberspace, and I'd be a cat, and you'd be a dog, and we'd have to figure out how we related. And actually, reality is somehow more interesting than any representation of it.
Right. And you had mentioned that depictions of science are generally negative in the culture now, and of the future are very dystopian at this point. Elysium, Avatar, the kind of pop culture views of science tend to be very negative. I wonder if that isn't because largely people have a hard time seeing themselves in these highly instrumented worlds that people like you are building. Normal people look at this and they think, okay, the sort of standard path of getting a degree isn't going to work in this. It's going to be a different economic picture. Everything's being disrupted. How do I envision myself in this world?
Well, it's, you know, people, I think these were questions people also could ask in the 19th and 20th century with the Industrial Revolution and all the changes that happened. And there was certainly a narrative at various points that it was very negative, that, you know, the machines were getting rid of labor, and so you had the Luddites that wanted to destroy all the machinery. Even though I think in aggregate the history of technology was one where it didn't reduce people's wages, it increased the productivity in the economy, and it ultimately freed people up to do other more productive things, even though there was certainly a lot of dislocation involved. But I think the negativity around the future that we have today is quite a bit greater than it was, you know, 40, 50 years ago. You had Star Trek in the 60s was a optimistic science fiction show. The Jetsons are like it's like a reactionary aesthetic. It's like so dated, you know. It's clearly belongs to a bygone era.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, it is. You yourself have challenged the educational system, and said you are not preparing people for the future.
Well, the education system. You know, I think there is sort of a lot of, you know, it's I'm not even sure it's that controversial a view to say that we're in an education bubble. There was an article on TechCrunch where my views on this got written up, and the author sort of started the article by saying, this will offend a lot of the readers because Peter's going to be criticizing all the schools. And then you sort of looked at the comments, and you know, there were 350 comments, and I sort of went through and read them one day, and it was like about 70% were saying, yeah, actually, they're all sort of screwed up, and there's sort of a point, there's too much student debt, and people aren't learning real-world things. But you also have a point that the education bubble, even though people are very skeptical of it, it's kept going because we have no ideas what else to do. And so how does something keep working where people have deep misgivings, where, you know, the costs have gone up by 400% after inflation since 1980 for higher education? You have $1 trillion in student debt in the U.S. now, and it keeps getting piled on year after year because people don't have a good sense for what else to do.
Mm-hmm. We'll take a question from the audience. Someone asked for your thoughts on today's announcement of the eBay and PayPal split.
It's probably, I have not been involved with PayPal since 2002, I think it made a lot of sense for the two companies to be combined at the time. 75% of PayPal's payment volume in 02, 03 was related to eBay. It was down to about 50% by 2008. Today it's about 25 to 30%. So about 3/4 of PayPal's business is off of eBay. So there has been this gradual divergence over time, and it makes a lot more sense for them to be standalone separate companies today, just as it made a lot of sense for them to be combined 12 years ago.
Now, you set forth to essentially topple state-dominated currencies. Does
we didn't quite succeed at that.
You fell a little short, you know. That'll happen. Does Bitcoin stick in your craw?
You probably underestimate these things. So I would say was very deeply skeptical of Bitcoin when it started. It was like, oh, these were all the crazy cryptocurrency people we met at PayPal back in 99, 2000. They were totally wrong then. We know they're totally wrong now. So I think the initial bias on it was negative, both because we'd encountered some of these ideas before, and because there was a way in which PayPal had, we had had this idea that we were going to be the new world currency. This was what our T-shirts said. And so if we couldn't do it, obviously nobody else could. And
right.
So there always are these sorts of biases you have to be very aware of and try to overcome. I think Bitcoin has succeeded in creating a new currency, at least on the level of speculation. I think the big challenge for it at this point is that the payment system does not work very well. So PayPal thought we were going to create a currency. We ended up creating sort of a more modest payment system. Bitcoin has the currency, but doesn't quite work on the level of payments, at least for normal legal transactions. I mean, you might go through the convoluted details of making a Bitcoin payment if you're doing something massively illegal, but it's not clear that's a sufficient basis to keep it going.
Mm-hmm. Take me through a pitch you really like. You sit through a lot of pitches. How are they all the same, or what's one that really stands out that makes you move close?
I think the pitches generally don't matter that much at all.
Really?
It's really not the Shark Tank kind of view of the world where it's some sort of dramatic, exciting presentation. The part that works is, where there's a great history of the people. So I think the questions I like to zero in on are the team questions, and I always like to focus on the prehistory of the team. How did these people come together? How did they meet? A bad answer to the prehistory is we met a week ago at a networking event and we both decided to start a company just because we wanted to become entrepreneurs.
You're going to hate each other soon.
And that's sort of like we decided to... I decided to get married to the first person I met at the slot machines in Vegas. You might hit the jackpot. Probably
could
a bad
work.
Idea. Could work. Not advising it. The better answers are ones where there's sort of a long prehistory. You've been friends for a long time or talked about this for a long time, and you've thought about the roles, things like
Peter,
that.
Peter, for a person who believes in libertarian individualism and entrepreneurship, you believe in teams. You believe in close social connections.
I don't think there's anything incompatible with that.
Okay.
I mean, I think that...
You want to see how In the mythos of Silicon Valley, there is a strong leader. There's a Steve Jobs. There's a Bill Gates. There's, this single-minded, near Captain Ahab visionary who pushes it through.
Well,
you don't think that's exactly right.
There's someone who's very charismatic, but it works because they're able to bring all these great things out of people. I think the various accounts of Jobs are always way too, you have sort of all these sort of accounts where it's like Jobs was such a jerk, and you have sort of all these managers who were sort of handing out the Isaacson book, and it was like, I'm going to now take some lessons from it, I'll be more of a jerk from now on, but I'm just trying to be like Jobs. That's sort of the message they were sending
I'll be
to all
human
their
later.
And that's not why Jobs worked. It didn't work because he was mean to people. It worked because he inspired the people.
Yeah, he wanted them to reach something in themselves.
And so I think that's, so I think it always has that sort of social element.
Yeah. I suspect also, you know, he got thrown out because he was a jerk in the eyes of John Sculley. He then spent a lot of time at Pixar, which is a highly collaborative environment. And I don't think that was trivial in terms of the later success.
There probably was some maturation, some growth. I think there's always a question, you know, at what point are these companies mature? And sort of, you want to have a visionary founder, a charismatic founder, as long as you're building new things. And the judgment that the Apple board made in 1985 was that the home computer revolution was basically done, and henceforth it was all going to be marketing, and it's like selling Pepsi or something like that.
They were going to compete.
The key metric was to focus on brand, and so you know you had a monopoly on brand, but you didn't have to actually worry about the product. It was just, and you had to just sort of coast on the brand like Pepsi, which is also a monopoly on a brand level. And it turned out, no, there was actually lots of innovation still possible. When Jobs came back in 97, he still had another 14 years, so yeah. The board was at least 26 years too early in 85.
At the risk of asking you to walk into a fist, what's an idea you wish someone would bring you?
Oh, that's like, if I knew that, I would...
You'd have somebody already, do it.
I'd already fund it or something.
Right. You're spending a lot of time in biology, aren't you? I mean, you did a diabetes company recently.
I would say the bulk of our focus is still on all the computer-related things, but it's certainly an area that when you look at a lot of things, it looks like they can work. There's often all these concerns about the time horizons. Do people work? I think science-driven companies, when you have companies that are driven by engineers, they tend to often be bad at the business side. The scientists tend to be catastrophic at the business side. And they sort of have all these extraordinary delusions about how the science will sell itself, how the world's going to beat a path to your doorstep to get it done, and so I think on consumer internet businesses, people, they can sometimes work even if the people aren't that good at business, because you get so much momentum it just sort of takes off and you can sort of figure out all the business details later. I think these hardcore science companies, it's actually far more critical to have a great business person involved. And so I really like the scientist plus strong business person combination. And that's very rare, but when it happens, it's really good.
That's a little bit like a number of successful companies in the Valley. Bill and Dave, Bill and Steve, Steve and Steve, a Mr. Inside who's very technical, and then someone on the outside who's more public-facing, sales, managerial.
I'm still a big fan of that model. You know, it's shifted a little bit heavily towards the two engineers or all product or all inside, and I think in some ways this is if you sort of think about the history, I think a lot of this was a response to the dot-com bubble and the aftermath. There was a microcosm of this at PayPal. In 1999, we had the engineering team, and then you had all the smart non-engineering people, and there's always a question, what do you do with them? And in 99, they all worked on business development. They were all into networking.
Right.
And then by 2001, they had all sort of migrated over to product. So it sort of shifted from externally facing, but then we realized the rest of the world didn't like us. They didn't want to do deals with us. It shifted towards this inward facing, a product where you had to build a product that would grow virally, and you'd sort of use marketing or viral marketing to get customers, but you wouldn't do it through complex business deals or complex sales. And I think that shift from 99 to 2001 is a microcosm of the shift that happened in Silicon Valley, where the 90s Silicon Valley companies, you'd have someone like a Larry Ellison at Oracle, was like an iconic 90s Silicon Valley CEO. Jobs in the 2000s was just the product visionary, mm-hmm. much more inward focused. So I do think there's probably a lot to be explored in looking at the outward and inward combination once again.
To circle back to what you're saying about believing in something you believe deeply,
you do seem to tie viral growth to a kind of product excellence that is around one's vision of how the world ought to be. And that product is an expression of it. And the interesting thing is that resonates with other people, hopefully other people who are like you. I mean, famously, Google did not advertise for years. And they actually did in certain ways that were very attractive to other hardcore engineers. And it was a way of reinforcing the very engineering-driven idea of the product and the company.
Yes, it's always, the distribution question is always this incredibly hard question. You know, it's if you build it, will they come? How do you, you know, how do you get a lot of people excited about
Super Bowl ad?
It's, you know, I think sales works best when it's hidden, and so
that's right.
You might get people excited about your product if you have math puzzles on billboards for engineering positions at your company.
Right.
That might be a far more effective advertising thing than a Super Bowl ad.
But also a product, as I say, product excellence, something that deeply reflects what your vision was and not just the superficial reflection of what your vision was.
Well, it's always, now this is always, you always want to, I mean, it's always a focus on substance. I always think you want to maintain that focus on substance, and if you ever lose that, you're really in trouble. Mm.
This is an interesting question. How important do you believe it is to have for an entrepreneur to have a mentor?
I'm a bit skeptical of this, actually. You know, it's always an awkward question for me to answer. I don't feel I really had a mentor. Most of the people that I know who've done well in Silicon Valley, I'm not sure how well-defined a mentor they had.
You had extraordinarily close friendships.
You have great friendships, which is a little bit more horizontal. You have there are some people from whom you learn various things, but there's always this sense that I have that you know, every moment in business happens only once, and so, you know, the next Mark Zuckerberg won't be building a social network, the next Bill Gates won't be building an operating system, and so if you're sort of trying to copy these people, you're not learning from them, and so I do think we're always looking for some kind of a scientific type of a formula, where, you know, okay, you do these things, you get a mentor, you follow these instructions, and then you will have a successful company. And you know, science begins with the number two. It begins with things that are repeatable,
yeah,
and experimentally observable.
Falsifiability.
And there is a way in which, you know, zero to one, we don't even get to two. We get to, it's just, how do you go from zero to one? And so I think there is something about the history of business that's not strictly scientific. I don't want to position this as a non-scientific book, but I'll describe it as an anti-pseudoscientific book.
Well, it's sort of what happens after the science.
I think most business books, I think, are pseudoscientific because they pretend that there's a science when there really isn't.
Yeah, it's there are deep subjective elements in this, aren't there? There is no pattern.
There are always questions about finding value in fresh and strange places. There's there's a version of this PayPal talk I used to give about how, you know, there were all these, we would just be telling all these stories about what happened in 99 when we built PayPal, and that's not terribly helpful for people. It was the right time to combine email and money.
Right.
You couldn't have done it in 1985, 2014, it's kind of too late, it's been done. And so there are sort of, there's a right time and place for things, but it's always a new question, what are the things that are, you know, for which the time is right now.
That's one of the questions from the audience is what fields are ripe for innovation or disruption? And I suspect that's a little bit like what's an idea you'd like to have brought to you. The answer is the one where someone can figure out a way to combine novel elements and create something new.
I'm always skeptical of the themes where people have these categories that they then try to put a lot of stuff into. I always think that ends up involving things that are sort of poorly defined.
Mm-hmm.
And so if it's so themes like education software companies or healthcare IT companies or cloud computing or big data, which, you know, I think are sort of borderline fraudulent themes, or SaaS computing, or the mobile internet.
You have fans.
Those are sort of like poorly defined. When you end up doing them, you end up doing things that lots of other people are doing. And I think the great ones are often ones where it's pretty hard to explain exactly what category it fits into.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like we're investors in Airbnb, and you know they've tried to position it sort of as a sharing economy company, but it's really just a unique, one of a kind service. And if there had been a theme that described it, you would have already had lots of other companies that were doing kind of similar things, and again, it wouldn't be differentiated.
Do you ever fix broken companies, large ones, incumbents? Because I was going to ask you, what would your advice be to a taxi company in the face of Uber? What would you tell them to do?
I generally am not that good at fixing those sorts of companies.
Because I wanted to ask you, what would you do with a server company in the face of cloud computing?
Yeah. It's probably, you know, I think in a lot of these cases, it's not fully frontal and you shouldn't be psyched into changing. So I think the hotel industry vis-a-vis Airbnb is not going to have to change that radically. I think we will still have lots of hotels, maybe even more hotels than we do today 20 years from now. And Airbnb is just sort of additive. Uber and taxis, I think, is a little bit trickier.
How about the New York Times company in the face of Facebook and Twitter? What would you advise us to do?
No, but I think my general advice is that you stick to what you do really well. The challenge for the New York Times is not that it's bad at technology, that you guys don't know how to design your websites or things like that. I think that all that stuff is perfectly adequate. The challenge the internet poses to the newspaper and old media companies is that it disrupted the business model. And this again is another version of how we always downplay monopoly. So the deep truth about the New York Times was that it had a fantastic monopoly for many, many years.
I would argue every city newspaper basically commanded space and time for that information area, like every morning for that town, space and time. They had it.
But I don't know how well understood that was by all the rank and file people who worked at these. I think this was understood on the level of the publishers, of the owners of the papers. But I think
it only occurred to me after it blew up and the internet took it away.
But that's
got kind of personal.
So the internet disrupted a business model, and the question is how do you get back to a monopoly? I think the New York Times is doing it roughly correctly, which is you're trying to, you know, leverage the brand to become sort of the establishment newspaper for the United States.
A question from the audience. How do you ensure a monopoly situation if you're building a community? Do you think Facebook has a monopoly currently in the face of Elo or Twitter to some extent?
Well, I think network effects are classic monopoly businesses. I think that Facebook started with 10,000 people at Harvard and went from 0 to 60% market share in 10 days, which was a very strong start.
When you met Zuck, how many people had he signed up?
It was about 100,000. They were 20 colleges.
What did you see?
I thought it was a sum of a whole set of tiny monopolies at every college, and it was going to scale. I thought that Reed and I had done a lot of our homework on the social networking, but the pitch meeting, Mark was very introverted, didn't say very much, so it would not have done well on Shark Tank.
Right. let's see. Oh, someone asks, if you were still in charge of PayPal, would you have tried to spin it out of eBay? I guess you spoke to that. Let me ask, when eBay goes public, will you buy shares in it?
Generally, I generally don't invest in single name public companies. I think there's so many complexities around insider trading at this point. I feel there's just so much stuff I know or somewhat know that I just prefer not to even buy and sell public shares or do it under very controlled circumstances.
Between your own and other people's, how much money are you managing now?
A fair amount. I don't know. We have about.
What does that mean in your world? A fair amount.
We have about.
Because in my world, it's got a whole different definition.
We have about just under $3 billion across the different venture funds.
Is it hard to place that much money?
It's a lot easier than it was in the 90s, which is sort of the baseline people use, because the IPOs are happening much later. So, you know, Amazon went public at a valuation of $450 million. Yahoo went public at a valuation of $350 million. And at this point, companies keep raising funds for many, many years later. And IPOs today are as unfashionable and undesirable as they were fashionable in 99.
Well, speaking of something that might be disrupted, do you think public companies and public markets will exist in this form in the future?
You know, I think they will. They'll continue to exist, but there is a it is sort of an interesting question whether you could build a company in Silicon Valley and never take it public.
That's the tension at Palantir.
It's the tension at SpaceX. It's the tension at it's the tension at many of these companies. But there is this deep sense that that when you take a company public, you get pushed onto Wall Street's timetable. You get pushed onto this quarterly earnings cycle.
You have to keep doing the thing you were doing because they've all modeled against that cash flow.
Yeah. I mean, you can. I think Google did a very admirable job in just resisting this and saying, you know, we're never going to give any guidance. We're not going to play any of those games. But you're always pressured to that in some extent.
Someone wants to know if you foresee a libertarian president within your lifetime.
No.
I should say, I asked him one of the things he believes and other people don't, and longevity came up. So, you know, we're talking, when we say in your lifetime, we're talking potentially 200 or 300 years.
Still no.
Why but, is that?
I think it's, that's the why questions are always hard to answer.
This has more to do with democracy than libertarianism,
yeah,
perhaps.
Yeah, no, I think that we are, I do think the ideas will get more resonance. So I think that the country will be socially somewhat more liberal. Fiscally, it may become somewhat more conservative, hard to say. But I think we will become less interventionist in the decades ahead. And so I think we will become less involved in all these wars. And so I do think things will, there's certain elements where I think things will change.
You know, the nation state arose within a certain model and at a certain time in a certain technological domain. And if you looked at its functions, many of them have to do with preserving borders. The postal system, that's been undermined by email. Currency, that's been undermined by your payments efforts and Bitcoin. One could argue violence. And now even language itself is going to fall away in the face of translation. Do you think the nation state survives?
Probably in some form. You know, I always think it's an interesting question to ask: how many nations will exist in the world in 2050? And you sort of have like these three scenarios: will be like far more than today,
right,
far fewer than today, or just the same number. And then there's a
not answering the question.
And then there's a complicated way where you can then also say you'll have smaller units, but there'll be parts of larger units, and so that you have sort of all these different federalist system, or something like that.
Yeah, for certain tasks they'll unify, and for others they'll separate. Something like that. You could have models along those lines.
I think it's a technological question whether we move towards centralization or decentralization. Even within computer technology, mm-hmm, this has been, you know, we've had sort of wildly different accounts of the future of the computer age. In the 1960s, 1950s, 1960s. The future looked like a few large computers that had all the data and would run the planet. There was one of the original...
Isn't that Amazon Web Services?
Well, you know, one of the original Star Trek episodes had this planet Beta, where this computer that had been programmed by this guy Landru was running it 8,000 years after his death. So it was like this benevolent dictatorship, and the people were sort of docile, not much to happen. And of course, they followed the Prime Directive and blew up the computer.
It was running Windows 15,
0.2 or something. And then in the 90s, you had this very opposite version where computer technology was going to lead to decentralization, and it was going to be, you know, home computers were going to empower people. It started maybe with fax machines, leading to the breakup of the Soviet Union, and you had sort of this view of the computer age leading towards fragmentation and decentralization. We've probably at this point sort of come back massively. The pendulum has swung back from decentralization to centralization. But if you just sort of realize the history, it can really go either way.
I think when we think about the way we talk about individuals in society right now, you can see just how strange a period we're in, where we say people have never had more access to information, but they've also never been more confused and divided up as a political group. We've never had more individual power. We've never been under more surveillance. You know, we see the future in terms of these extremes that almost make you feel like something's going to change.
Well, the future is by definition a time when things look very different from the present. And so,
big periods of history weren't like that.
Yeah, I'm defining the future that way.
Yeah,
it could be like a never-ending process.
You go, yeah.
But
I think that's right. We're in a period of accelerated change.
At some point, things will change. Yes.
This is a great question. A key problem for tech startups is building an effective network of friends, partners, and customers, because they are too focused on the tech. Can you offer any insight on how they can overcome this? That is to say, balance focusing on technology with building up a system of friends and allies.
I'll just repeat what I said earlier. My intuition is that often this is a division of labor. You have different people doing this. You know, the people who are good at sales are often not good at tech. Typically, these are very different sorts of skills, and that's why I think it's natural for these to be often divided up among different people.
Mm-hmm. Someone yearns to know, is your Thiel Fellows program encouraging delusional wannabes to drop out of school and become entrepreneurs?
Well, certainly, we certainly hope not. We're in the fourth year of the program. We've had 83 people go through it. The first year group, which was 2011-2012, had 24 people. Five of them did end up going back to school, which and I think they probably had learned a lot in those 2 years that helped them. We never frame it in terms of dropping out. It's always stopping out, and I do think that it's sufficiently selective that the people in it get a lot. It's not a template. It's not a template for everybody.
I got sympathy with that delusional thing, though, because you know it's posited as an alternative to higher education. But every one of these guys is out of Yale and Harvard and Princeton, and you know you can walk around the valley and say, I was at Yale, but then I became a Thiel Fellow instead. And it's not going to be a black mark. You know, we're still operating inside a very elite level here.
Well, you have to design it in that way. You don't want it, otherwise, if you had not designed it that way, I mean, this is a critique of the program, but you couldn't design it and say, we're going to take everybody.
You're risking people's futures.
At that point, you're really risking people's futures.
Yeah, it's a fair.
We're not risking anybody's future.
Mm-hmm. Are you still encouraging kids to drop out of school?
I'm encouraging people to think, and I think, there's nothing wrong with education, but it's always worth asking why are you doing this, and you should never use education as a substitute for thinking about your future. So if you say, I don't know what I'm going to do in the future, I'm just going to get this degree.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what I'm going to do with this degree, I'll get a grad degree.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what I'm going to do with this graduate school degree, I'll get a consulting job so I can figure out what kind of job to get down the line.
One of these days I'm going to live my own life, but I just got to...
And so if we think of our lives as endlessly option generating as a way of avoiding thinking about it, in any concrete terms. That I'm not convinced that's the best way to do it. That's we've all been tracked very powerfully in that direction. Not sure that's the best way for it to be.
You've read a lot of philosophy and very deeply, and there is a strand in talking about how to prepare for the world or how to live in the world that involves both preparation and luck. Aristotle talks about developing character but also having fortune. Machiavelli talks about virtue and fortuna. How much of your own outcome do you ascribe to luck?
Well, this always is sort of a...
And is that a bad thing?
The politically correct answer at this point is always to say that it's a huge amount of luck is involved, and I actually think it's really hard to know because you can't run the experiment twice.
Yes.
And so luck involved. In theory, the experiment would involve some sort of standard deviation on a large sample size, but a sample size of one. So it's actually very hard to figure out how much luck is involved. And so my contrarian bias is to always push back a little bit on how much we ascribe to luck. A venture capital version of this that I think is something that it's always very good to resist is you see all these companies and you can say, well, I don't really know if it's going to work or not. It's a matter of luck. And so I'll just invest an intermediate amount, and it's a lottery ticket. And when you treat entrepreneurs and the companies they found as lottery tickets, I think that's a bad way to treat the people, and it's also a bad way to invest, because in practice I found that when you multiply a small probability by a very big number, it normally comes out to being a small number. And so the question is always when we ascribe luck to something, are we actually making a statement about the deep nature of reality, or are we simply saying that we're too lazy to think about things right now, and we're just, where luck is just like, it's like an atheistic word for God?
It might also be said, and luck is considered a bad thing, but it might also be said that, certainly for anyone in this room, we're all phenomenally lucky in space and time. Anyone in history would kill to be us, right? Antibiotics, universal suffrage, these are fairly recent developments. So to measure luck in our time is...
Yeah, I'm always...
Is that a little too long range for you?
I'm more interested in the questions about the future. Like, what can we do today? And what can we do about the future? And is that dominated by luck or not?
Okay.
I think that's where I always think it's good to push back against...
This is where change can occur. Right.
This is, we can't do anything about the past. What can we do about the future? And how much of that is in our control? How much is just random chance?
Okay, and this will have to be the last question, unfortunately, because we have such a stack of good ones. As globalization continues, will there be more opportunity in developing countries such as China or less opportunity?
Well, I think there will be... I think this is a conventional view that I happen to share, which is that I think there will be definitely more opportunity. China's economy has been growing very fast. It probably will keep growing fast for a long time. I don't necessarily think there will be that much more within the technology sector in China. And one of the things I contrast very sharply in my book is globalization and technology. I define globalization as copying things that work, going from one to n, extensive horizontal growth.
It's a kind of arbitrage.
It's a kind of arbitrage. China's done a phenomenal job with it. You skip some steps. You can make it go really fast. And they still have a lot of room left in that arb, probably. There's a possibility the arb's running out because of environmental constraints or things. But I think they probably still have quite a lot of room left in that, but I think it's in the developed world that technology is critical, where we need to go from zero to one, do new things, vertical or intensive progress. One way to see that technology and globalization are very different is just to think about the history of the last 200 years. 19th century, we had both globalization and technology, tons of progress in both. After 1914, globalization goes into reverse. You have less trade, less connection between people, and technology keeps going at a very fast clip. 1971, Kissinger goes to China. Globalization starts again with a vengeance, and I would argue technology keeps going, but with a narrower focus on computers. So the 20th century, we sort of had a period of massive technology and negative globalization, globalization in reverse, and then the last 40 years, we had massive globalization and more limited technology. And we sort of talked about the world in very different ways during those periods. In the 50s and 60s, you would have talked about the first world and the third world. The first world was the part that was seeing accelerating technological change. The third world was that part that was sort of permanently screwed up. Today, we talk about the developed and developing worlds. The developing countries are those that are converging with the developed world, so this is a pro-globalization dichotomy. But it's also an anti-technology dichotomy, because when we say that we're living in the developed world, we are implicitly saying that we're living in that part of the world that's finished, done, where nothing new is going to happen, that's stagnant.
Model.
And I think we should not accept the label that we're in the developed world.
Right.
We should always ask the question, how can we go about developing?
We are all in the developing world in that sense.
How can we develop the so-called developed world?
Right. Well, I'm sorry we are under the clock, because the wealth of questions I've had here indicates an enormous enthusiasm for your ideas and your book. I wish you great fortune and success. Can you believe I said that? Like you needed more. I meant with the book.
I've been starting to say that I don't want to wish people good luck ever, given what I said. So I always started to say I wish you more than good luck.
Yeah. Well, you know, the sales will matter, right? Okay. Well, thank you so much.
Awesome. Great to talk to you.
Thank you very much.